I've got some exciting news. I've just signed up for Coral and I can't wait to get started. Coral is a virtual clinic designed for women in midlife. They provide personalized, evidence-based care that supports every woman's unique journey in perimenopause, menopause, and the years beyond.
Whether you're looking for immediate relief for your symptoms or you want to focus on your health and longevity, their incredible team of women's health experts offer ongoing medical and lifestyle interventions for perimenopause, menopause, sexual health, weight management, and longevity. No matter where you are in your journey, they've got a program for you.
So because my menopause symptoms are mostly under control right now, give or take, I signed up for their Healthy Aging program, and that focuses on preventative wellness. I am desperately looking for help with things like sleep, mental clarity, energy, strength, and making confident choices about what my body needs as I age, because I'm getting older. Coral gives me data-driven expert guidance, so I don't have to figure it out all alone.
I am so jealous you get to start before me. Uh-huh. Coral isn't in Alberta just yet, but they're coming soon and I'll be the first in line.
Well, and so you don't feel left out, Mick, I will be sure to share my Coral journey with you and our whole community. I'm actually starting this week with comprehensive blood work and their in-depth questionnaires so I can get a very full picture of what my health is. Because, you know, I'm a bit of an oversharer, I will be sure to give you updates as I go through it.
Yes, you do love to share. And speaking of sharing, we've got an exclusive code for our listeners who are looking for support for their perimenopause symptoms. Visit coral.ca to learn which program is best for you and then use code TIP5, T-I-P-5, at checkout for 5% off. That's TIP5 at coral.ca. Time to get the midlife care you deserve. Oh my God. I can't believe the conversation we just had. She is incredible.
Like mind blown wide open. It was fascinating. But also, like, it was a conversation that I needed to have. I needed to know this stuff, and yet I didn't even ever think to ask.
Right. And I've because of the CVD risk on both sides of my family, I've been at this right. for a while. yeah, heavy duty. We don't need to get into that, but heavy duty CVD risk. And I've never had a conversation like that.
She's amazing. Yeah.
She is incredible. I cannot wait to share this with everybody, about something so important that affects everyone. Leading cause of death globally and leading cause of death for women postmenopause.
Yes. Right?
Cardiovascular disease. And most of us don't even know that. And we don't know what it is we're supposed to be monitoring and looking at. And honestly, we're all pretty complacent about this stuff.
Like seriously complacent. Like I knew that it was the leading cause of death in women and my mother died of a heart attack. And yet I still was like, I don't know, head of my, like, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm going to be pushing everybody I know to listen to this. Really, really, really important information. And you've got to take charge, right? You can't just assume. It's not realistic or fair to assume your doctor or whoever your main medical provider is on top of this stuff. I mean, they are overwhelmed. They've got a lot of things to manage. We've all got to learn this stuff and ask and monitor and really become the leader on our own teams in terms of prevention. That's just the facts.
Absolutely. And today's conversation with Dr. Diana Castleman, who is with Lume Women's Health, is illuminating and something that, as you said, you're going to tell everyone to listen to. Like, this is so important. And she's a naturopathic doctor. And yet you were the one that found the post where she was on Instagram saying, hey, we should be on statins, maybe. Like,
well, yeah, that. There are times when she will absolutely recommend statins, and coming from a naturopath, yeah. I think that would be shocking to most people. But the context and nuance is not understood, and it is critical to everyone's health. So if you haven't listened, listen.
Yeah. This is perimenopause.
Dr. Diana, welcome. We're so excited to finally meet you and have this conversation.
I'm so excited too. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. We want to talk with you about all things heart health today, or cardiovascular health. Mm-hmm. You had an Instagram post this summer that I suspect probably shocked a lot of people, where you stated that you're a naturopathic doctor and you recommend statins. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that post and let's dive in.
Yes, definitely raised some questions from some people for sure. I'm really happy to discuss that today. I really wanted to make that post because I was having so many conversations in my office about medication use in certain situations where I really thought the patient was a good candidate. And a lot of my patients told me they felt like a failure because they had to go on medication. And I think it just opened up this conversation about how we are not failing if we need that medication to help prevent cardiovascular disease. And it, I really became passionate about more openly talking about that. And I've actually received a lot of positive responses as well from many women who follow me who felt very validated in that actually because they had a lot of shame, a lot of guilt around needing that medication. And I think we really need to crack open that conversation more and talk about it more.
Yeah, I actually have like zero knowledge on this subject today. So I'm so excited to hear about all of this.
So maybe what are statins?
Okay. So I think to have this conversation, if it's okay, why don't we back up a little bit and just talk about in general, like what is cholesterol? Like what is your LDL cholesterol? Because then it will kind of lead into what statins are.
Perfect.
So if you get like a lipid panel, a cholesterol panel, when you go get blood work with your doctor, you will see that part of that panel will be something called LDL cholesterol. And so LDL stands for low density lipoprotein. Basically, it's a type of particle that carries cholesterol throughout your bloodstream. And I always explain it to my patients, like think of them as balls. There are these balls that are floating around in your bloodstream that carry cholesterol. And so that LDL cholesterol measurement that you see is looking at the amount of cholesterol that's inside these balls, right? That are floating around. And so it doesn't actually tell us how many balls do you have though, like how many of those are in your bloodstream. And that's where we use another marker called ApoB. I don't know if you guys have heard of ApoB. It stands for apolipoprotein B. It's basically a protein that's found on the surface of these lipoprotein balls, so to speak, that are atherogenic, that basically can cause that plaque buildup. And so each of these balls has exactly one ApoB on it. And that's where it will give us a more accurate representation of like how many of these, if we want to call them bad, like, you know, particles, bad balls are floating around in our circulation. So if we think about like a highway analogy, ApoB is looking at how many cars do we have on the highway? And LDL cholesterol looks at like the passengers in these cars, like how many passengers do we have? So I kind of like that analogy and it helps my patients to really understand because ApoB has actually been talked about for many years and it is another marker that you can get on your blood work and it kind of gives us a more, you know, full picture of your cardiovascular risk. And so basically if we have less ApoB, that means we have less of these balls. That's less of a probability that ball can cause damage to our artery wall.
If I have a really high LDL, but a really low ApoB, hand in hand?
Typically, they go hand in hand a lot because about 90% of our like particles of that carry ApoB are LDL cholesterol particles. So oftentimes, like they do go a little bit hand in hand. If someone has high LDL cholesterol, they typically have elevated ApoB. But again, ApoB is also looking at other particles that also are atherogenic. It's not just LDL cholesterol. Like there are other particles like lipoprotein little A, which I'll talk about in more detail, but they often go a little bit hand in hand.
Okay.
And when you say atherogenic, can you describe that, what that is?
So basically, when we use the word atherosclerosis, this is a common word that we use in the cardiovascular disease space. I want you to think about your arteries, like your blood vessels, as these flexible pipes. And over time, if we have, let's say, too much cholesterol in our bloodstream, we can have what are called these fatty deposits, or what we call plaques. They can start to build inside of these pipes. And so basically they can make those walls thicker and stiffer. And so these pipes are not as flexible anymore. And if we have a rupture of any of these plaques, that's essentially what can lead to, let's say, a block of blood flow. And that could be like a heart attack, a stroke, things like that. So when we say atherosclerosis, we're talking about that buildup of plaque within our arteries. And atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease is the most common type of cardiovascular disease. And that's why we focus so much about on it, is because it's the leading cause of death and disability globally. So that's why we often use that term a lot. We're trying to prevent atherosclerosis from happening.
Also the leading cause of death of women who are postmenopausal, right?
Correct. Postmenopausally, correct. And this is why it's such an important conversation, because the best thing we can do is prevention, right? We can work on prevention. And so this is what I talk a lot about, is that the things you do now in your 40s and 50s and in this perimenopause stage is going to affect your health outcomes for decades to come, right? But that can be a very empowering thing, that things we do now are going to really benefit us for decades to come.
I don't want to jump around too much, but am I, like, at what age do I start getting tested? Do I, every time I go in for, like, I'm going for a blood work, blood panel next week. Will they automatically be testing for this as well, or?
Great question. So cholesterol for sure is typically part as like your sort of comprehensive screening that you do with your family doctor. Some other markers are not always included. So ApoB, for example, typically you do have to ask for. There is another marker that I encourage my patients to ask their doctors about, which is called lipoprotein little A. So lipoprotein little A is a form of an LDL, like this atherogenic particle. It also can promote that formation of plaque in the arteries, but it's a very highly genetically determined marker. So over 90% of it is genetically determined. So you can have amazing, you know, nutrition, lifestyle, diet practices, but they don't significantly impact it. And the Canadian Cardiovascular Society recommends that everyone over the age of 40 test this once in their lifetime. So you don't need to repeat it, because it's genetically determined. And about 1 in 5 people have elevated levels. So about 20% of the population. I mean, that's not insignificant, right? And so what I like to tell my patients, it's not something you did, you know, to cause these elevated levels, but we should know if it is elevated, because it's going to add an additional risk factor, right, that we need to take into account. So elevated levels, if we're talking, again, in Canada, you're looking at over 100 nanomoles per liter on blood work, that would be considered an elevated amount. Again, you only need to test this once in your lifetime. But for example, if I have a patient who has elevated lipoprotein A, it means we might be a little bit more aggressive in our prevention approach, knowing that they have this additional risk factor. So it's really important to know. And I think that's a really great part of a comprehensive cardiovascular risk assessment at midlife.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I'm going to get that added. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Now, yeah, like, you're welcome.
My mother died of a heart attack. So I'm like, interesting. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you're so welcome. And then the other thing I always like to talk to my patients about is what happens at menopause, because this is everyone's question. They're like, mm-hmm. I never had elevated cholesterol, and now, like, what's happening, right? Why am I all of a sudden seeing this increase? So what we see in the research is that over the span of about 20 years, so from 40 to 60 years of age, our LDL cholesterol increases on average about 0.05 millimoles per liter on blood work. So over the span of 20 years, that's about 1 point. So let's say you had an LDL cholesterol of 3, it can go to 4, right? Kind of, again, over the span of 20 years, it's not happening overnight. But there's kind of some thoughts about why this is happening. We know that as our estrogen declines, there can be some impact there because estrogen does play a really important role in cholesterol metabolism. And basically, it's going to cause downregulation of our LDL receptors at the liver. So what that means is just that we're not clearing that cholesterol as efficiently at the level of the liver. We know that body composition changes around this time. Uh-huh. So a lot of women can see, right, those body composition changes. Maybe they have more visceral fat, which we know can contribute to higher cholesterol. Of course, lifestyle factors, right? Like if we're maybe really suffering with symptoms, maybe we're less active, changes to our diet. So there's, you know, kind of a multitude of factors that can play a role here. But the key thing here is that if we are seeing these increases, and we're only going to see them if we're, you know, testing on our blood work, that we are creating an action plan and we're creating a treatment plan about what we're going to do about it.
Amazing.
Yeah, I'm a little overwhelmed right now. Like, just in the sense that I feel healthy and I feel like I shouldn't be worried about this, but I kind of am now. Hopefully by the end I'll be relaxed again, but I feel like I need to take some action.
Yeah, I think with the information you'll be empowered. I understand at the beginning can be overwhelming because maybe this is, you know, the first time you maybe have had a conversation with your practitioner about it. But I do truly believe prevention is everything. Mm-hmm. And the more that we have these conversations and open up and understand like what our numbers mean, like the number of times that I've said to my patients, like, what is your LDL cholesterol? What has been over the years? And we don't know, right? Like we don't know what those numbers are. And that's okay. It's never too late to learn. But like, let's understand those numbers. Like, I think that's instead of, you know, doing your blood work and then, you know, we never get a call back and then like, it just, you know, it, you know, that's it. We don't know what to do about it. I really like to put my patients in the driver's seat of their health and say, okay, like if you are going, you know, for annual or every 2 year blood work, whatever that is for you, like, here's what your number should be and make sure you track it, right? Because yes, you're not going to feel increases in your cholesterol. I explain, it's not like, you know, you have a migraine headache, you know, you take something for it, it goes away. Cholesterol is not that way. You're going to work on your cholesterol. If it's high, it's going to come down. You're going to feel the same. Like it's really, you're not going to feel symptoms unless, of course, an event happens. And mm-hmm. So this is why we need to be on top of our screening and understand those numbers.
Can we talk about ranges? Is that appropriate?
Yeah, for sure.
And these will be ranges for Canada. We do have listeners from across the globe, so...
Correct. So there are going to be different like units also in the States. So if you're in the United States, they're just different units. So just keep in mind, you're going to have to convert these numbers that I mentioned. So what I want to say here, let's talk about the LDL cholesterol. The number that we're looking for is going to depend on someone's risk factors, right? So I mentioned to you lipoprotein A. So that's a risk factor that can enhance someone's risk. And so if someone has elevated lipoprotein A, we might want their LDL cholesterol to be even lower, right, than someone who doesn't have it elevated because they just have additional risk, right? So it's hard to kind of give a very concrete number. However, I can kind of give some guidelines around this. Yeah. What we know for sure is anything over 4.9 millimoles per liter on blood work for your LDL cholesterol is considered very high and needs to be treated, okay? So that we know for sure it's included in the guidelines. And again, that's going to get stricter as someone's risks go up, right? So if someone is, you know, has high blood pressure, they're also a smoker and they have elevated lipoprotein A, right? As you can see, they have more risks. So then we need to make sure their LDL is more in check. Now, if you go, for example, to Life Labs, you will see that when you get your cholesterol numbers back, they will say anything under 3.5 is considered normal. A recent paper that was published by The Lancet, which is like a prestigious medical journal, that looked at it being under 3.3 for optimal health. So sometimes different studies will quote these, especially for like dementia prevention and optimal brain health, they kind of quote under 3.3. So it's a ballpark range, but like I said, the more risk factors you have, the more that we maybe need to be stricter with our criteria. So I hope that helps.
Very helpful.
Sorry, what is the connection with cholesterol and dementia?
Yes, that's a big topic. It's one that definitely I get a lot of questions about.
I'm still not getting more relieved. I'm getting I'm like, oh no.
I'll check in about 10 minutes. So the dementia conversation, so there is a report that got released last year in 2024 by The Lancet. It's one of the, you know, world's most influential peer-reviewed medical journals. And they have a group that basically looks at dementia risk factors. And they have like periodic updates basically as we have new evidence. So as of 2024, they added high LDL cholesterol to the list of modifiable dementia risk factors. So now there's 14 modifiable risk factors for dementia, meaning there's something that we can do about it, right, to reduce our risk. And those 14 modifiable risk factors, it estimates about a 45% of dementia cases that could be prevented, right? So that's quite a large amount if we focus on that.
That's it. Yeah.
So basically almost half, amount. Right? That's what we're talking almost about. Half that we can focus on prevention. Wow. So again, that's empowering. Like there's a lot that we can do there. And that includes, you know, exercise and nutrition and a lot of those good stuff. But now they've added high LDL cholesterol as something that we should be targeting starting in midlife as part of our dementia prevention. And again, that's alongside blood pressure control and diabetes prevention, smoking cessation, all those things that we know. But this is one that actually a lot of people don't know, that they've included this now as part of the dementia prevention to make sure that we are keeping those levels in check. Because again, the biggest thing that I also talk to my patients about is this concept called cholesterol years, which basically looks at the longer that we have this elevated cholesterol, the higher our risk. Right. So if I have someone, let's say, you know, I'm throwing numbers out there. Let's say she's 52, she's coming into my office, and let's say brain health, right, is a goal of hers, amazing health goal to have, you know, to optimize her brain function. And she's had elevated LDL cholesterol for 10 years, but quite high elevated levels. I probably would be way more aggressive in my approach than someone who's had it elevated for 6 months. Right? Because that's 10 years of that additional potential atherosclerosis that could have been occurring. So we're going to be a little bit more aggressive in our approach and in trying to get that down. Right? So keeping that in mind too, of like how long it's been elevated is an important concept to keep in mind.
Okay. So we keep talking about your approach and what you would do. And so like, walk me off the ledge. What do we do?
Give me all the things. There's one other thing I want to mention with assessment. Sorry, because I think this is really, really important and I want listeners to know about this. There is a calculator score, basically, that we can look at someone's 10-year cardiovascular risk, okay? And it's commonly run in many practices. In Canada here, we have what's called the Framingham Risk Calculator. So it's going to basically ask you your age, your sex, you know, your total cholesterol levels, your HDL cholesterol, your systolic blood pressure, if you have diabetes, if you're a smoker, if you have family history of premature cardiovascular disease. So it's going to ask you all these questions, and then it gives you this 10-year risk score, basically. So it's saying in 10 years, what is the likelihood of you having an event, right? And the number one thing I want to highlight with this risk calculator, it is going to fail to identify younger women who could really benefit from early prevention, because risk scores are really driven by age. So if you're 49, it's going to say, well, by 59, you're still quite low risk, right? And so the reason why I really want to bring this up, because this is such a missed opportunity for early prevention, because again, it's not flagging younger women. It's not going to flag women in their 30s, 40s, 50s. It's saying you're not high risk. And so what that's going to do is that if we're using just that marker alone to determine what our treatment plan is, we're going to delay treatment, right? We're going to delay doing something about it because we're saying, well, you're low risk, you're under 10%. And so we can still do these calculators and use it as a guide, but it's not the full picture. So I just want to highlight that because I think it's a really, really important conversation. So again, if we're just relying solely on that 10-year score, it's going to really underestimate risk in midlife women.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, so important, right? And even just getting a baseline.
Exactly.
So that you understand at age, let's say 40, yes, 35, whatever, what your LDL level is. And then, because I'm assuming all of the things you've talked about, the context of how much it's gone up is also as important as what the actual number is, right?
Exactly. You're getting the concept. I love it. Yeah, it's exactly it.
Wow. We're all going to get blood work tomorrow.
You mentioned HDL. Is that the quote unquote good cholesterol? Is that
what? Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you brought this up. Yeah, people hold on to their HDL.
Doesn't matter, my HDL is good. So, look at this.
Exactly. Number. Yeah, that's actually part of one of the myths that I always bust is that because people feel like, well, my HDL is fine, and because it's historically been labeled as this good cholesterol, they're like, it almost – it implies that like it's protective, like it's protective against your LDL cholesterol. It is not, and I really want to highlight that.
Wow.
So we are – with HDL cholesterol – we are actually, I think, truly in the infancy of really understanding like what this cholesterol particle does, because we – like when we've looked at, for example, increasing it in studies, right, it never actually led to any significant benefits like, you know, to people, like cardioprotective benefits. So we don't try to increase it. So, you know, if someone's – if that is a goal of yours, please don't let that be a goal of yours. It's not going to be – lead to cardioprotective effects. So even if your HDL cholesterol is good, even the arbitrary cutoff of like you want it to be over 1.3, like it's just such an arbitrary number that it is thrown there. It's really not our focus. It's because LDL cholesterol is causally related to cardiovascular disease, right? And that's been proven time and time again with many, many, many different studies. So every time when we lower LDL cholesterol in a group of people versus not lower it, the group that has the lower LDL cholesterol has consistently lower heart disease risk.
Love what you're hearing? Don't miss our weekly newsletter. It's got expert advice, evidence-based resources, practical tips, and of course, a little humor.
Go to thisisperimenopause.com to subscribe and join the thousands of women who have realized they need and deserve better.
So to circle back, I think we were going to go on statins, and here we are.
Here we are. Well, I think right, you've really, really, in a very easy to understand way, outlined what matters and why.
Exactly.
And yeah, like, please tell us. So what does prevention look like? Obviously context is important, but in general, what are the things that, we people and women in particular, given we're on a podcast about perimenopause, what do we need to do, to give us the best shot possible of living long, healthy,
vibrant
lives. Yeah. Vibrant. I love it. So I just want to highlight, when I'm going to be talking about medications, this is not ignoring diet lifestyle pieces, because I think people kind of sometimes feel like, oh, we're talking about medications, that automatically means we're ignoring all the other things. That is not the case. And we often obviously get the best outcomes when we look at incorporating those pieces, right? So I always talk about the pillars of our health, the pillars of health being exercise, nutrition, stress management, and sleep. They're always going to be incredibly important and always part of our treatment plan.
Sorry, I just want to jump in, and I don't know if this is the right time, but I think nutrition and cholesterol, if we could go down a bit of a rabbit hole or talk about that a little more in depth, like, are eggs evil?
So typically when we focus overall on cholesterol, what we're trying to do is decrease saturated fat intake and increase our fiber intake. That's always going to be kind of like the principles of what we're going to try to do, and that has the biggest impact. At best, if someone is, you know, really adhering to a Mediterranean style diet, like that is the gold standard diet for cardiovascular health, we're going to see about a 30% improvement, right, at best. Now that can vary again from person to person, also depends what your starting, you know, risk is. So what that means when we're talking about saturated fat, you know, decreasing things like red meat intake, again, depending on what someone's baseline is. So the carnivore diet is the worst diet for cardiovascular health. We don't want to engage in that one. There are certain, it's not, for example, like all dairy, but some dairy, of course, will have higher saturated fat intake. So just looking at those portions and those amounts is what I like to guide my patients in. Fiber, we want to be aiming for about that, you know, 25 to 30 grams of fiber a day. And we want at least 10 grams of that to be soluble fiber. So We get soluble fiber from a few different sources. It could be things like oats and oat products. Psyllium is a great example. And actually, psyllium is what is in Metamucil, right? So for example, a lot of people, you know, take Metamucil. It's really psyllium husk is what is in that. And that has had good studies, you know, to really help support overall cholesterol. So that's kind of like the main sort of base that we focus on. Of course, we also talk about like alcohol intake and those pieces too. It's important to address. But let's say I have someone coming into my office, you know, they have slightly elevated cholesterol. This was something new that, you know, that's come up for them. It is completely reasonable, of course, to take that dietary lifestyle approach. And let's say, let's give it 3 to 6 months, right? Like, let's do these changes. I think where people sometimes get overwhelmed, in their doctor's offices, and I understand it's often a time limit and the amount of time you can spend with your doctor, is they will tell you, you know, okay, here's the Mediterranean diet. The problem is you go home and you read this Mediterranean and you're just so overwhelmed. You're like, where do I even begin? Like, they, obviously there's like this entire, you know, 14 pages that I have to read, and where do I start? So what I really try to do in my practice, you know, I have the fortune of being able to spend time with my patients. And so what I will do is I will really try to understand what your day-to-day looks like. I will ask very specific questions, and then I'm going to give you like 4 tasks, right? I'm going to say, okay, I want you to do this, 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 and this until next time we meet. And let's just focus on those things to help see how it's going to help your cholesterol levels. That might not mean in 3 months it's completely normalized, but you'll see changes. It's about having a targeted plan and a plan of action, and then making sure that we are retesting. Do you want me to go into the statins conversation? Yeah. Okay. So statins are a type of medication that helps to lower cholesterol. They basically work by blocking cholesterol production in the liver. So basically it blocks this enzyme called HMG-CoA reductase, and it's a key enzyme in the liver that is used to make cholesterol. So that's essentially how it works in a nutshell. They've been studied for decades. We have a lot of research on them. Actually, the first statin was released in 1987. So we have a lot of data, including in women.
Is it all on men?
No, there have been studies in women. Of course, we always need more research, you know, when it comes to women's health. I will always say that, of course, but there have been studies done in women. And so if you ever hear like, oh no, they don't work in women, that's actually not true. They have been studied in women as well. I think there's a few different reasons why, again, the conversation has become polarized. I think in a lot of wellness circles, you know, there's often, again, the strong emphasis that natural is better. You know, medications can, again, be seen as last resort or a failure. There can be side effects concerns. And I feel like the side effects really get amplified online, even though majority of people really tolerate them well. I think the side effects spread quickly, right? Even though, like, we have millions of people that take these medications successfully and, you know, don't post about it, right?
Yeah.
So it can be kind of that bias. Sometimes women also have poor experiences with the medical system, right? They maybe feel dismissed, rushed, or they're prescribed that medication without explanation. And so kind of this creates the skepticism about what this is really going to do for me. And then also, if we've had family members or relatives who are maybe over-medicated, right? Like, we may resist this idea of needing medication ourselves because we have this certain viewpoint of what it's looked like for family members. And then I mentioned that guilt component, right? That idea of like important to reframe it as a tool and not a personal failure.
And I think maybe good context here as well, something else you say that probably shocks a lot of people, particularly because you are a naturopath, is the fact that you can't out lifestyle your genetics, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot you can do, but sometimes, and your point about if you have the genetic predisposition or the marker for what was it, LDL or
lipoprotein little A. I also will say, yeah, even if, let's say, lipoprotein little A is not elevated for you, it doesn't mean that there might not be other genetic factors at play, because there's so many genes, of course, that you know, have a role in cholesterol metabolism. Right. But yes, it's this idea of like, if you've, again, given it a really good runway, you know, a really good shot, and you're doing all the things, and it's not where we would like it to be, you know, again, it's this idea of, well, then maybe we could potentially explore that option for you, right? Yeah. Because again, it is about prevention, right? This is where we're going to make the biggest impact. And so I think when it comes to women's health, when we discuss the effectiveness of statins in women, we have, again, really concrete data for like secondary prevention, right? So we know there's significant evidence that statins work equally as effectively in women in the studies that did include women in secondary prevention, meaning that an event has already happened and we're trying to prevent another one. I think where the controversy is, and this is where there's a lot of he said, she said, like depending on who you follow online, the controversy is more, do statins help in primary prevention in women, meaning that they've never had a cardiac event and we're trying to prevent the first event.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's where definitely we could have more studies, because the studies that even have included women, they don't all report sex-specific results, right? And we need those sex-specific results to be reported. There are definitely some that have, but a lot that also haven't. And so that's where I think more and more research is going to be coming out. But I think even, like I said, with the data we do have in how important it is to manage things like LDL cholesterol, I think we have enough that it really is a shared decision-making process. It's such an individualized decision, right, to make with your doctor and based on your health history, right? So this is, again, not a blanket statement, but the cholesterol guidelines state that women should be treated with statins for primary and secondary prevention when the benefit outweighs the risk, and it's an individualized assessment for the person.
And I think that, right, what you've just said is the crux of the problem, is that we've now had a 38-minute conversation about this, in that most people do not have the benefit of this, not just the level of expertise, but the ability to share it in a way that lay people can understand, or that patients can understand, and guide us, guide you through all of the nuance and context here, right? Yeah. Like the approach is often, I think it's so polarized because there's this binary approach. Mm-hmm. Statins are bad or statins are
exactly
good. Well, no, there's this whole right scale in between that no one's even talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's actually, I think you bring up such a good point, because I think that the nuance is what is so hard to convey on social media, because it's it's all sound bites, right? Like it's all just little context, 10 second clips. There's no way you can capture nuance in a 10 second clip, but that's what catches attention.
Yeah.
And so even I have struggled so much with how do I have this conversation online, because in my office, it's an hour and a half conversation. So how do I even start to have that conversation? And sometimes it's multiple visits, right? Like someone's not going to necessarily make a decision on the first visit, and that's totally fine. It's about a continuous conversation, right? And I keep also reiterating, because I see this messaging online that, you know, menopause is like causing heart disease, and it's not true. Menopause is not causing heart disease, but yes, the drop in estrogen can essentially just remove a layer of protection. Again, that's where the context is missing.
Okay, let's talk MHT, because that's another one where, you know,
to be half 4 hours.
But online, again, like some people are saying yes, and some people are saying no, it doesn't help. And how do we know? What do we know?
I'll give context, because I think that is my strength. I think my strength lies in educating on the research, educating what we have. And again, I keep coming back to shared decision-making, right? Like, you know, helping the patient come to that decision with themselves and what they're looking for. It's a dual relationship, right? So if we look at all of the menopause guidelines globally, they do not recommend menopause hormone therapy for primary or secondary prevention of cardiovascular disease. Okay, so that's kind of listed in all the menopause guidelines. Some people will argue online, well, it's because they're not updated and things like that. That's not true, but I just want to give some context to where that is coming from. So I'll There's a lot of studies I can talk about, but I'll just kind of highlight two key ones that are often talked about in the space. One of the studies is called ELITE. It was a study that was published in 2015. And it was looking basically at the effects of estradiol treatment, so taking estrogen therapy versus placebo, on cardiovascular health. And they were specifically looking at one metric, which is the what's called carotid intima media thickness, so CIMT. It's basically just an ultrasound test that measures the thickness of the inner two layers of your carotid artery walls, which is, again, responsible for supplying blood to the brain. And it basically helps us assess the risk of cardiovascular disease because it's looking at detecting early atherosclerosis, as we talked about. So it's basically looking at that one marker. And so participants were split into two groups based on their time from menopause. We had a group that were within 6 years of their last menstrual period, and then group that was more than 10 years over their last menstrual period. And then the treatment group received oral estrogen, 1 milligram oral estrogen, and then they also had progesterone for uterine protection, and then there was the placebo. And the key finding in the study and in ELITE, and this is what often gets talked about as like a a benefit for MHT for cardiovascular prevention, was that if you were less than 6 years from menopause, you had less progression of the CIMT test in the treatment group versus the placebo. And that beneficial effect wasn't there if you started over 10 years, right, after your last menstrual period. And so this is where the whole idea of like the timing hypothesis comes in, this window of opportunity where it's, okay, if we're going to start, you know, hormone therapy for cardiovascular protection, you want to be in this window, right? Like in this window recently from your period. And so it just suggested that, hey, maybe there could be this cardioprotective sort of role. Now, again, it's important to mention they looked at this one marker of CMT. It wasn't looking like at adverse clinical events, you know, like heart attacks, stroke, things like that. But again, it was a trial that a lot of people cite as saying, okay, well, there is benefits here. Now, when we look at, I always like to differentiate between using menopause hormone therapy versus statins for cholesterol, because this is one of the number one questions I get asked is, well, I'm just going to use estrogen to help decrease my cholesterol. Like, why am I going to use a statin medication? There are some head-to-head trials that have compared statins to menopause hormone therapy. Now, a lot of them are smaller, short-term trials that are really focused on that cholesterol component. But in every direct comparison that has been done, the statin lowered LDL cholesterol more than menopause hormone therapy. It outperformed it in pretty much every single direct comparison. Now, a few trials did test the combination of menopause hormone therapy and a statin, and there could be some additive lipid effects there, meaning that there could be some like enhancement when you use both. But you will also see that a lot of the menopause hormone therapy trials will say that it uniquely improved HDL cholesterol, which, coming back to the fact that it's not really that clinically, you know, relevant for us. And so I really like to highlight that, because if we're talking about specifically the efficacy between menopause hormone therapy and statins for lipid lowering effects, I'm going to choose the statin every time. Right. And so again, it's this idea of, I'm not saying there can't be some cardioprotective benefits of estrogen, especially started within a window. But again, if our goal is lipid lowering, right, if someone has an LDL cholesterol 5, you know, and we're trying to get it as close to 3 or under 3, I'm not going to use estrogen for that. Does that make sense? So it also depends like what our goals are there. And then there's been a lot of trials that have been neutral, basically saying, there is no harm, there's no benefit, but there essentially is really no evidence of cardioprotective benefits. And a lot of the trials have been done with oral estrogen, which is also important to keep in mind, because many women now are taking transdermal estrogen on the skin, right? Like gels or patches. And so the transdermal data is very scarce. There is one trial called KEEPS that was one of the few trials that included transdermal estrogen in it, but that was the one that was neutral. It was kind of like no harm, no cardioprotective benefit. And so as you can see, when we have some of this mixed data and mixed trials, it's of course difficult for guidelines to make this, you know, bold statement to say, okay, it's going to prevent, you know, primary prevention of cardiovascular disease or secondary prevention, right? The question is this data enough to change guidelines? And I think a lot of experts in the field right now would say no, like it's not enough data to change guideline evidence. But then people will use information like the ELITE trial that I just explained to say, well, I want to do because this, you know, this trial showed that there was potentially some benefit. So again, it's nuanced. It's a nuanced conversation. It's about shared decision making. You know, for example, we also know that if someone has debilitating, you know, moderate to severe hot flashes, night sweats, it's associated, right, with an increase in potential association. But it's important to note that in the SWAN study, it showed a potential increase in cardiovascular disease risk. So again, I think it's context. Context matters. It's of the person in front of you. And are they having any other symptoms? What if they had no menopause symptoms and they solely want to take estrogen for cardiovascular prevention? I don't know. I don't necessarily, like I said, have a concrete answer to that based on like the evidence and the data. It also depends on the practitioner, I think, like maybe would say otherwise. But for solely cardiovascular disease prevention, I don't think it's very robust, especially for, like I said, if we're using transdermal, you know, estrogen. So I hope that kind of helped guide. I know that people want the black and white answers for sure, but I think it's also just important to cite the studies and say, hey, here's what we have. How do you feel about it?
Right. Let's stop infantilizing women or, you know, and let us make our own decisions. Give us the information. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. Give you the information. Yeah.
And bust the myth that there is no black and white.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And where is the science today? And science is iterative, right? It's always about getting more information and then making the best decision possible and continuing on that path. Mm-hmm. And you can't, you know, your health requires a toolkit. Perimenopause requires a toolkit.
Exactly.
And there are going to be a lot of things in that toolkit. And there is no one magic bullet that fixes anything mm-hmm. and everything. Right. And unfortunately, the challenge, I think, is our healthcare system and globally healthcare systems are not set up mm-hmm. to allow people to understand the context and nuance that is crucial to their health and to how to best manage their health, mm-hmm. right? And that's why naturopaths, I think, are such an important part of our respective teams when it comes to helping us make the best decisions possible, because your structure is, let's step back and understand you as an individual and what you need. And that is so, so important.
Yes, exactly.
And now you're with Loom, Women's,
yes.
Women's Health. Is that where everyone can come in? Like, is that, that's where your practice is?
Yes.
So when you, so I think it's also probably, Loom is a pretty magical spot, and we'll definitely link to it in the show notes. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Loom and how that team works together?
I'd love to. Yes, I'm really, really happy to be part of the Loom team. So Loom, we're located in Toronto at Bloor and Church. We're a midlife women's health clinic, and we really have a team of integrative practitioners. So we have medical doctors, nurse practitioner, pelvic floor physiotherapist, me as the naturopath. We have a chiropractor, yeah, psychologist. We have a full team ready to help support you, which is incredible. I will say, I think this is honestly what every woman wants, right? They want a team approach that, you know, everyone is working on together. And so, you know, a woman has access to be able to, you know, access all of us. And the beautiful part about that is because we're all in the same clinic, we can discuss that. You know, I always like will ask permission for my patients to say, are you okay if I discuss this with my colleague? And they're like, yes, please. Like, I'd love to get their input, you know, because we do have case study reviews that we do every 2 weeks together. So we all come together, put our heads together, and we'll discuss, right? We'll discuss the cases. We'll be like, what would you do in this case? Here's how I would approach it. And honestly, seeing all those different angles and like all those different experts coming together and sharing like their expertise, I think is like invaluable. It really is. So it's wonderful to be part of the team. Yeah, I'm really honored to help women navigate their midlife care there. And I just wanted to highlight, I'm in Toronto, and then I also have a practice in Oakville as well.
Oh, okay. Awesome. Yeah. Actually, it's interesting. Yeah. The team aspect is really key to me these days. I have a friend who has been suffering from anxiety and also from high blood pressure. And finally, they went to a different clinic, but they finally put the pieces together when they had – they were being treated separately by different practitioners for these. And finally, someone looked and went, oh, well, your particular blood pressure meds that you're on, that actually there's a known side effect of that is higher anxiety, like anxiety. Like, and like – bam, like finally they have a team looking at this and talking and having these conversations, and they can go, oh wait, let's flag this, and now they're feeling a lot better. You know, it's not magical overnight, but it's so important, instead of being in these silos where no one is looking after our whole health. So that's
100%
awesome. Yeah so good. Would love to know, what is the one thing, Dr. Diana, that you would love every woman to know about perimenopause and their heart health?
So many things. But if I were to summarize this conversation, I would say prevention is where you have the most impact, right? What you do now in your 40s and 50s can change the trajectory of your heart health for decades. So that's incredibly valuable. I do think cardiovascular disease remains underdetected, undertreated in women. And I wanted to give some tips and tools today of what to look for, right? So that is not you, so that you don't feel like you're being missed. Because again, perimenopause is a critical window of opportunity, right? Where we can really have a big impact. Again, we talked about the risk score. So just know that it shouldn't be based full treatment plans just based on that risk score itself, that you've not failed if you are taking medication. And the other thing I wanted to mention actually that I forgot to highlight is that there are also very sex specific risk factors that I think should really be part of your cardiovascular screening. So for example, for women, knowing your pregnancy outcomes, like did you have preeclampsia, gestational diabetes, gestational hypertension, that actually impacts your cardiovascular risk down the road. And again, these are things that risk scores don't take into account, right? Do you have PCOS, like looking at your history there, because that is associated with a higher prevalence of hypertension, metabolic syndrome. So important that we are also as clinicians, making sure that we're looking at these sex-specific risk factors. And if you feel like you have not been asked about it in your visits, bringing that up as well in your healthcare visits, because like I said, that does also change your risk. And I think that's really important to highlight as well. And then the other thing I would really say is that also ethnicity does play a big role. Research shows that South Asian women, Hispanic, Chinese, North American, and Afro-Caribbean women also have greater risk factors of cardiovascular disease. So keeping in mind the ethnicity piece as well. But the good news is you can do a lot of good. Yeah.
Amazing. So Michelle, are you still super stressed?
Okay. No, I'm good. I'm good now. Actually, yes, I feel good. The
blood
good.
Pressure. Mission accomplished, good. Dr. Diana, mission accomplished. Are we going to get to see you in person at the National Menopause Show?
Yes, I am going to be there with the Loom team. Yay. Yes. That's awesome. Yes.
Excellent. Yes. Excellent. Good. Well, we will find you. Maybe we can have a little quick chat on the floor. Are you speaking?
I won't be speaking, but I'll be at the booth, at the Loom booth. Amazing. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll get you to speak to us again.
Yes. Looking forward to it.
That'd be great. Okay. Well, we can't wait to see you in person.
Yes.
Thank you. This mind-blowing, and I'm going to make sure that everyone I know listens to this start. Actually, once they start, they're going to absolutely want to finish, because this is incredible information. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it was wonderful. Incredible.
I'm so glad. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and write a review,
so more women can find us and get a better understanding of what to expect in perimenopause.
This information is not intended as medical advice. The intent of this information is to provide the listener with knowledge to support more efficient and effective communication with their medical provider.